Hello, everyone. Today, we're honored to have co-founder and CEO of Tranquility Online, Joel Muse, on the podcast. Tranquility is an online software-as-a-service-based platform that makes getting help for anxiety easy, affordable, and convenient. Tranquility uses the gold standard evidence-based approach, cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, to allow their clients to live their best lives. Their service also includes help from trained coaches every step of the way.
On the podcast, we discussed the challenge and personal sacrifice involved in a tech startup, Joel's own mental health struggles, and the current state of the healthcare system and where he feels Tranquility could fill some gaps. We hope you enjoy the discussion.
Okay, Joel, well, thanks for joining us on the podcast.
No problem.
I'm not sure where we're best to get started, but maybe you can tell everyone a little bit about who you are and what you're mainly focused on today, let's say.
Right. So, just like you, Jeff, I grew up and was kind of always fascinated with the concept of you could make money while not working, which is why the stock market was always fascinating to me. One day, I basically learned what a chartered financial analyst designation is and was like, oh, I need to do that. That's what I need to do. So I did. I graduated from SMU. While I was there, I was involved in a student-led investments, let's call it club, where the actual students would actually have real money invested in stocks, come up with, I guess, recommendations. We had to get a mentor who was a industry expert to approve it. Then we would manage a portfolio like that. So I wanted to be an analyst who would analyze a stock and make buy, sell, or hold recommendations. And then I graduated, and it was 08, 09, the worst time in history. Well, not maybe not history, modern day history, to graduate and want to join that industry. And I had a bunch of different people that I went to talk to get advice. I'm like, how do I get into the industry? Everyone gave me the same advice. You got to move to Toronto or New York, get 3 to 4 years of experience. Then maybe you could get a job in Halifax because there's not a lot of jobs there. I was stubborn and didn't do that, and one of my mentors from that program worked at a buy-side firm in Halifax, and one day she calls me up and says, was talking to the CEO, we need an analyst, you have a meeting. And I met with him, I met with the CIO, I had another interview with one of the portfolio managers, and the next thing I know, I was working out of like rotation. So I started off in like the back office for 4 months. And then basically you're like, you're wasting your time in the back office. Like, we need you doing research. Office, like, we need you doing research and coming up, like, helping us make decisions. So pretty quickly I started doing research and pursuing my CFA, finished the exams, finished that. And then I was in the industry. And then 6 years later, I burnt out. While that was happening, I struggled to get help within the public system and figure out what was wrong with me. I had a lot of physical manifestations of different symptoms. Name a symptom, I had it. Turns out it was all mental health related. And didn't know what I was going to do until I signed up for an online program based out of like California that helped me a lot with my social anxiety that was based on cognitive behavioral therapy. And I was like, this should be done for all anxiety, probably depression too. There's not a lot of other things out there. And at the same time as that was happening, I had a few friends who had kind of started their own startups, and I saw them getting success. I saw that there was a community in Halifax that was growing for that with a lot of different support. And I honestly, like looking back now, I still don't know where I got the courage to be like, oh yeah, I'm going to do this. But I did. And it was like one step at a time. Like the first thing I did was like join a little program that involved a pitch competition. And I came in second place. And then I was like, oh, this is validation. And one thing led to another. And here I am today, co-founder and CEO of Tranquility Online. We're basically an online platform to help people with anxiety and depression. We use the gold standard called cognitive behavioral therapy. And our platform is like online behavioral therapy. and our platform is like online education and skills, which is how CBT works. So CBT is short for cognitive behavioral therapy, plus coaching. So it's like a self-help program, but we add coaching because I always make the analogy that it's kind of like Weight Watchers. If everyone knows what they want to do, if they want to lose weight, they have to burn calories and eat better, but not everyone knows what eating better means. Weight Watchers create this really simplified point system. Today, you can Google the point system and figure it out, but Weight Watchers is still like a $3.3 billion company. So what people are paying for is to sign up and have the accountability of coaching or groups or whatever it is. So similar to that, we've made CBT as simple as possible, but we also supply the encouragement and accountability from a coach, which we train and monitor. And that's basically where I am today.
Like, there were so many things in there that I wanted to kind of jump in, but I wanted to let you finish. Like, I kind of chuckled in my head when you had said you were stubborn, you didn't want to leave, because I certainly know how that feels.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes I've referred to that as the Atlantic Canadian sickness. I don't know if I've ever mentioned that to you. We want to make less money, have less job opportunity, and pay more taxes, and yet we never want to leave. And the second we leave, we can't help but want to come back right away. So it seems like we shared a lot of those. But I'm still, the last few times we talked, I'm still trying to get out. You said you don't know where you found the courage.
Yeah.
I think that would be fair that you don't know where to find you find the courage, because I certainly don't know where you could have found that courage.
Right.
I cannot envision myself, even if things weren't going, you know, well in my career, maybe I could do something else, but I'm not sure if I would have the courage to start something from scratch.
Yeah.
And to paint a picture here, at the time that you had to find that courage, you know, things were not well in the life of Joel. This is, you know, and I don't know where that all lines up with regards to your blog post, which I think was a pivotal moment for your, you know, the life that you're in now. It certainly was for me, because there was stuff when I was reading that blog post, I remember texting you, like, you know, the day that I read it, thinking, geez, I was there through all of this. I never noticed a thing, right? Mm. So looking back, you do. But at the time, I'm just some oblivious, stupid kid in the reality of it. I guess what I'm trying to say is there any way you could begin to explain where that courage came from?
No, you're right. Part of it actually does have to do with the encouragement I got from that blog post. So for the listeners, to paint a bit of a picture, is like, this was before I left my career in the industry. It was probably around Bella's Talk Day, and I had made a habit, you know, before that, every year, to just kind of put it out there, like, hey, this is a really important day. I want to admit that I struggle with this stuff, and it's okay if you do, and if you ever need someone to talk to, let me know, or it's okay to ask for help from anyone, type thing. I did that, and then a couple days later, a friend of ours actually just sent me a Facebook Messenger message and was like, hey Joel, I saw your post, do you mind like expanding on that? And I was like, oh, yeah, sure. And I'm like, I still remember it now. I'm like sitting on my chair, and I kind of start, and I just keep going. I don't even let him respond. I just keep going. I'm like, oh, okay. I'm gonna say this. Like, I'm being really honest with him, and maybe because it was over text, I was probably more honest than I usually would be at that point in time. And so I tell him like a lot of the story, like the stuff that, especially at that point, felt very shameful to me. And then his response was just like, wow, I had no idea. And also, I felt that too. And that makes sense that you would have felt that way. And I know what you're talking about. And I was just taken aback, because in my head, this guy was someone who I thought like had everything together. He was like one of the cool kids, and I was one of the losers, the way I was looking at it when we were in high school. So I was super surprised, and after that experience, I was like, oh, if that's his response, then maybe other people respond similarly, or other people want to hear this or else. So then I basically took what I told him, but elaborated on it even more. And I started writing it out on Facebook as a post, and I had to, like, stop. I was like, oh, this is way too long to be a friggin' post. Like, this is long. I forget how long. It's probably, like, a 20-minute read or something on not on Medium, but whatever it was. I literally, like, it was the first blog I ever wrote, and I had to create a blog website for it to host it. And the idea was just, like, I don't know, like, 20 or 30 of my friends will read it. 48 hours later, 4,000 people read it, and, like, 100 people, like, commented or reached out to me and all this kind of stuff. And it wasn't just my story about, like, I feel this way or this is what I went through. It was also, this is what I went through and this is how the system failed me. So a lot of the feedback was that, too. Like, it was either, I've gone through this, too, or, wow, you are right, I've gone through this, too, or, wow, you are right, and, like, the system's broken and we need to fix it. And then I guess another thing that did happen was a psychologist who created this, like, coaching program reached out to me and said, like, do you want to be part of the solution? If you do, I'll give you a scholarship to go through this coaching course. In the meantime of, like, before that started and that, I had been finally seeing a psychologist. And, like you said, I wasn't doing well. And I think part of me started realizing the hard truth, which was I'm not into my job. And I'm getting, and I couldn't really do the job anymore, to be honest with you. Like, I would get an email, and I had so much, quote-unquote, like, brain fog that I would read the email, like, 3 times because I would get distracted when I was reading it. Like, I was really burnt out at that point, and was just like, I need time off. Like, So my psychologist and my family doctor were like, if you need to go off work right now, that's probably the best thing to do. You know, I went off short-term disability at first, and then 12 weeks later, it's not like I was doing any better, so then I went on long-term disability. Then in the meantime, started thinking about, like, what am I going to do next? I know it's not going back in the investment world. So maybe it's courage, maybe it's literally desperation. Because it's like, I also had to do something else.
Yeah, that all makes good sense. It's just, I think if we had, you know, let's say another 1,000 people on the podcast and they had a similar story that they were doing some job they didn't like and they, you know, they burned out and they were suffering with brain fog and various other things, I'm not sure that they would have found the courage to take all that, negativity, let's say, and turn it into something that you're trying to change so that other people don't feel this way.
Right.
Right. And not only do that, but at the same time have no income dependence.
Right, right.
You know, like, this is a degree of courage in which encouraged me to want to have you on the podcast.
Yeah.
This was, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to have you on. If there's anything, any inspiring thing that we could say, it would be that, you know, somebody can do this, right?
Yeah. And that was your thing too, right? Like, this is going to sound, I'm not sure what it's going to sound like, but it is kind of true. It's basically like, I had a few friends who from what I've seen, were being successful starting their own startup. And I was just like, they're not smarter than I am. Like, come on, like this is a good idea, like, also, right? Like, I'm not sure why other people aren't doing this right now, but this isn't crazy.
Well, I think you're right. It's just, I think most people aren't willing to suffer that much.
Yeah, well, in this whole journey, for sure.
Joel, I'm meeting you today for the first time,
right?
But I did my homework before meeting you and getting ready for this conversation. And what I find about you online, just reading up on you on the surface, I mean, here's a guy who's achieved, you know, the highest level of certification in the finance industry, being the Chartered Financial Analyst designation. For those that don't know, I mean, it requires a high degree of it's academic rigor and analytical ability, and you've achieved the designation. You've had some senior level positions in the finance industry. You're a good looking guy to boot. You kind of tick all the boxes. It's kind of annoying. But at the end of the day, so I guess the point of the question is, perception is one thing. When you read about someone or you hear something about someone, you think this guy's got everything together. He's got it made. What more could he want out of life? He's kind of carved out his own little piece of paradise and he's owning it. But yet, the Joel inside was quite the opposite. You know, arguably during one of your most formative years, you were struggling with anxiety, you were struggling with you know, what you were doing and not getting the kind of fulfillment that you were expecting, and mm-hmm. not without necessarily knowing what you wanted. So, I mean, fast forward to today, you're very open about the fact that, you know, you've had your own struggles with mental health, and that's led to kind of where you are today and the man that you are today. So if you were to, I mean, it's always easier to connect the dots kind of looking back, but if you were to talk to that, I guess if I can call you a kid 20 years ago or whoever, and what you know today, what would be that kind of advice, or what do you wish you would have known then that you know about yourself now that got you to this place? And where do you want to go from here?
I think, and I'm still, this is actually pretty new realization for me, is that I lived my life ways to make other people happy, so much so that I didn't even know what I wanted, and I'm still figuring that out now. And so in my household, the main value was work and money. And so I think I probably decided, do you know what the easiest way to get rich is and be successful and therefore happy is, you know, become this professional, and then like a really good industry would be join the go where the money is, right? So although I loved learning about the theory of finance and all that kind of stuff, I think once I left school and joined the industry, I realized it doesn't work that way, and I saw things that I didn't like. But at the end of the day, it also just, it wasn't giving me, like, I'm doing this every day to get a paycheck, and the only reward is the money part. And now I'm trying to shift still about not thinking about the money part and think more about, do I like what I'm doing? What do I get out of, what's the reward? Is the reward building a successful startup and selling it one day, or is it just helping a ton of people who need help? So I guess, again, like the advice to the younger self is learn who you are and don't be what other people want to be. Figure out what you want to be and then be the best version of that.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about Tranquility Online. I mean, you've already articulated to Jeff kind of how you conceptualized it and the advice that you got from others to kind of instill in your mind that this is something I want to give an honest go.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, a lot of startups, especially in Halifax, smaller market, you have the shift in mindset from money-driven to finding your true purpose. What were those first couple years like starting this business and how it became what it is today? And what's your vision for the company as the years go on?
Yeah. The difficult part is the fact that being a nobody, like, to be honest, like, I don't show up and decide I'm going to be a co-founder and CEO of a startup and have this, like, Rolodex of people I can reach out to. I don't have a reputation of being an entrepreneur. I had basically no choice but to bootstrap it. And as Jeff even mentioned, like, I also had no income for myself. The journey up to now was a lot of finding money through like pitch competition and like these little grants and then finding people who are willing to work for little to no money at first or only like or just like some equity, and getting to a point where we had something that was good enough to prototype and test. So then we put something together. I mean, to be fair, like, my co-founder is a clinical psychologist and an instructor at Dalhousie, has over 15 years of experience in doing this type of stuff. So I'm not saying like everything was legit, but it was done with, this wasn't a VC that backed this project from day one. This was a very slow build to getting to where we are today. So the first couple years was literally like grinding, like just me working as much as possible, our first developer working a massive amount of hours while he was still in school, just because basically that's the type of guy he is. He believed in like the mission, and he just, when I first met him, he's just like, I just want to build something. So at first it started off really small and took a really long time to get just to like a starting point, to the point where finally about 6 months ago, we got our first kind of pre-seed round from a few angel investors, where we were able to ramp up now that we have a staff of, you know, 3 developers, 2 psychologists, myself, 2 other staff, and a couple consultants. We're working with some money from the province as well, because our ultimate goal is to have this be like a part of the public system.
What do you mean by that exactly, part of the public system? That would be worth a lot. I think we should learn more about what you mean.
So there's almost like 3 different pathways for this. Number one is, and this is the current iteration of what Tranquility Online is, you know, if you or anyone you know currently have anxiety, or in a month from now, depression, because we'll be launching that pretty soon, you can go to our website, tranquility.app, and you can sign up. And basically, we do like a monthly subscription that comes with it's 9 different educational modules that unlock 4 different tools. The tools help you do kind of like the homework. And then you can either do it self-help or a coach. So, you know, B2C, direct consumer. That's kind of the first iteration of it. People need to pay for it out of their own pocket. And for a very small investment, I think that is completely worth it for anyone who would be struggling. I used a program similar to this, and it was the best $400 I've ever spent in my entire life. And when I say a subscription, the idea isn't you subscribe and we want you to stay on forever. The idea is like, hopefully in 4 months, you don't need us anymore. Second kind of market is employers have a huge incentive to make sure that their employees are healthy. So employers can sign up similar to like an employee assistance program. And if anyone on your staff suffering from anxiety or depression, that means that there's a high rate of absenteeism, which means people are missing work because they're sick, or presenteeism, which means they're showing up to work, but they're spending a lot of their time doing what I used to do, 15 minutes to read an email, right? So if you can offer, so in that sense, we kind of want the end client, the end user, the employee, not to have to pay for it, but for the employer to be like, hey, everybody, we've purchased Tranquility Online for all of you, and if any one of you want to sign up for it, you can do it for free because we're paying for it. But as you can remember from the blog post, the whole point of the blog was how the public system, in Canada, we have a public healthcare system. Well, it's not comprehensive. You still need to pay to go see the dentist, and for 6 to 12 months to see a psychologist within the public system, you have to hire a private one, and they usually check. If you're seeing a psychologist, the recommended rate, at least in Nova Scotia, it's similar all across Canada, is at least $190 an hour. So, you know, that's $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 you're going to spend on a psychologist. What we believe in is that mental health should be part of the public system, and people shouldn't have to wait 9 months, and things like Tranquility should be paid for by the taxpayers, basically, by the public system, which will actually save the public millions of dollars every year, because, first of all, if there's no wait times and you're making it way more accessible for people to sign up for things like this, they can get treatment a lot earlier in their path. They don't end up having to leave their job, being burnt out, going from having mild anxiety or depression to severe anxiety and depression and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, like our goal and mission in life is for you to be able to go see your family doctor and be like, I think I might be suffering from anxiety right now. And your doctor's like, okay, let's talk about that. Do a little assessment. Wow, you're right. Right now, you're showing symptoms of mild to moderate. At the moment, you have a few choices. Like today, the choices are really bad. They're either like, take this pill right now, or, you know, find $200 every 2 weeks to hire a psychologist, or wait a year. Fourth option could be try Tranquility Online or something like that. You know, cognitive behavioral therapy is the gold standard. It is what your doctor would recommend anyway, and we've made it accessible online with a coach, and that could take up like online with a coach, and that could take up like, I think like 70% of the people on the wait list right now fall into the mild to moderate anxiety or depression.
So Tranquility, do you view that as people using this in lieu of a psychologist, or is this as a bridge to make it to the psychologist? I guess I'm kind of thinking that, you know, some portion of the people that would sign up for Tranquility Online would have the mild to moderate anxiety or depression, or as you just described, and maybe they get it's cured, for lack of a better term, I'm not sure what we call this, in 3 or 4 months, and then they just end up going about their life and they feel better, and maybe they have some in the future, they have some kind of relapse, or once again, not sure what we call it in this space, but they go and maybe use Tranquility Online again. I'm curious to you know, is this being viewed as a bridge or a, you know, is this being viewed as a bridge or a replacement, acknowledging that there's no way it would be a bridge for everyone or a replacement for everyone.
Yeah.
Do we have an idea of the stats of how many people this is helping? How many of them have been able to go on and actually live a semi-normal life while they were waiting for their psychologist, perhaps? Like, do we have any idea about this?
So, Australia and the UK have been doing what I just described to you for 10 to 15 years now. So, back in that time, they were calling it computerized CBT, which I don't know for sure, but I'm assuming it meant you like probably got a DVD, CD-ROM, and you installed the software, and it was probably really clunky, but it works. So, all the academic and clinical research shows that CBT is like the most effective way to help people with anxiety, especially mild to moderate. For the most effective ways, it's not the only, like for anxiety, it's basically the way. For depression, it's one of a few ways that are equally effective. And then there's more research that shows online CBT is just as effective as that person-to-person CBT. And then I always say there's a caveat, which is if people actually do it. So we know if people sign up and actually go through the 9 modules and do the homework, they're going to get better. But that's difficult. It's the Weight Watchers analogy again, right? So
it's kind of like the I think, sorry to jump in.
Yeah.
One of the things I remember you saying before is that CBT, one of the things that it eventually gets you to do is you get exposure to the thing that you're, let's say, afraid of or anxious about.
Yeah.
And I presume some significant, or I would assume significant portion of the people have a really difficult time, even though they're being guided through this coach and online therapy, have a really difficult time finding that.
Yeah.
Like, would that be fair?
Yeah.
Is that the main limiting factor to why this wouldn't work?
Well, it's I think it's one of them for sure, because I think what we've seen from our competition is some of them are not even including exposure as part of their protocol. And we don't shy away from it. We're like, if you look at the research, exposure is usually the most beneficial part. And we can understand why our competition might not include it, because it means that they have higher dropout rates. So as a product, that's bad. But like, it's kind of like, we're kind of like, too bad, so sad. This is what works. So this is how you're going to do it. So we're not going to remove it because people drop off. We're going to work on getting our coaches to help people feel supported through that, and make sure that when we explain it, we explain to them like, it's really important to see how exposure works. Just to give a brief thing, is like, let's say I'll use my own experience. When I signed up for an alternative ICBT program, I wanted to work on my social anxiety. And specifically with my job, one thing that made me really anxious was networking events. So I said my goal was probably like, I want to go to a networking event and not be worried about this thing that happens to me. The thing that happened that would happen to me is if I would get embarrassed, my forehead would start sweating. And if my forehead started sweating, I would get really, really embarrassed and start thinking like, oh, does Jeff notice that my forehead is sweating? Then I'm just all in my head and all I want to do is run away. And then the last part was I learned through the program that I have a safety behavior for that, which is if I go to a networking event, the first thing I do is I go to the bar and have a drink because that helps me relax and there's a less likelihood that I'm going to feel anxious around this whole thing or else I go to a networking event. The thing you can, what you do is you don't just tell the clients you need to go to a networking event. You come up with, we call it a fear ladder, which is like, let's say, 7 steps of before you go to the networking event. So it's like, find ways to simulate some of that anxiety without putting you through the like the more severe version. So like steps could just be like, in my work meeting, I'm going to make sure I speak about, you know, speak up about the subject, blah, blah, blah. It's a bunch of different things. So there's the fact that people don't want to do exposure. There's also the fact that, like, it's just like anything else. It's like if you're reading a self-help book, you read what you're supposed to do, but you don't actually do it. So it's like doing the homework part. So to answer your question, exposure is one of the reasons why people would drop out. And there's a few other reasons why people drop out. It's also just like, you know, exposure part. It's just even think like spending time thinking about it. Like, I don't want to think about this right now kind of type thing.
So to come back to kind of the original, I guess, question I had, which was, do we know what percentage of people, I guess, are doing well, you know, are benefiting from this versus those that still need an intervention from a psychologist, for an example?
Yeah, so, I mean, I did say that basically the science shows that it's equivalent.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But I'm going to make, there's an important caveat, but this is also why this is really good for the public health system. It's equivalent in those mild to moderate cases. When you get to severe, then it might not be as good. Doesn't mean it's not going to, just it means it's potentially not. But what that means is, now what you can do is, you can get most people who are in that waiting list to do this program. Because today, you don't get triage if you go see your doctor. You show up, and if you're severe or you're mild, you're just back at the line. If you can take the people who have mild to moderate and do an online anything, doesn't even matter, like something that works online, then you're freeing up the time for the psychologists in the public system to focus more of their time working with people who have more serious issues, which is, again, going to be way more helpful to the public system.
I'm thinking about the year 2020, and, I mean, nobody saw what's come, what we've all experienced this year, not just with COVID, but... I mean, Nova Scotia has been through the ringer, if we can say it that, between Portapique and, you know, we've had losses in our military, and there's been a lot of devastation, which, and I mean no disrespect by saying this, but I would assume that's good for your business. I mean, there's a lot of people out there whose mental health is in crisis, and as a result of the majority of the working population migrating to all shifted from being maybe not as comfortable meeting in public to talk about the personal finances when you have no other option, and we provide that channel, that access, people have been receptive, and that realization alone has been, you know, an awakening for all of us in the industry. But getting back to the question, given all that's happened in Nova Scotia and given your business model and how the mentality of people and whether it's mental health or business, how that's shifted, how has that impacted your business?
The first thing we did when we realized, it was like I'm walking home from work one day, and I get a ping on my phone. The NBA has been canceled. I was like, oh, this is a real thing now. Like, that's the moment where I was like, this is serious. We had hired 2 new people, and they came in on a Monday for the first day of work, and then the next day we went work from home, and we didn't see each other for 3 months. And so we were sitting there and we're like, wow, this is going to affect people's mental health. What are we going to do about it? So the first thing we decided to do was to make Tranquility free for our basically healthcare heroes. So anyone who was like a frontline worker, we basically partnered with a few organizations, and those people were able to see that there was a code that allowed them to come to Tranquility for free. So we had a lot of people sign up and go through that. Then we had a bunch of people kind of just like find out on their own about it, because the other thing we did was people potentially are going to lose their jobs or their income's going to be cut, maybe they go on CERB, whatever it is. And this is still true today, we've cut our pricing by 50% for anyone who wants to sign up. And then we had employers sign up. And then we had employers and organizations reach out to us. Some that we had like reached out before, like, hey, this is what we're doing, blah, blah, blah. You know, a couple months in, like, hey, remember when we chatted? Yeah, we're more interested now. So there was like, it was like 14-hour days for me and my co-founder, just like having all these like business calls and pitches to, again, explain like our value and all that kind of stuff. Things have slowed down a bit now, I think maybe just because of summer. It also forced us to do a lot of things quicker, which put all my staff under a lot of pressure to like just work a lot more. Because like another thing we did was we added some content in our platform to specifically address COVID. Our platform at the moment has, when you're going through it, you follow these four different personas, and each of them have a different type of anxiety. And the fourth one had generalized anxiety, and this is pre-COVID. That anxiety for that persona manifested as like health-related anxiety. The persona's story is like, they're worried about their own health and their family's health. So we just turned that one into like being like completely like COVID related about that kind of stuff. But yeah, so it's been good, and it's made people realize also how important it is to have a virtual option. And I think that will continue, and there's going to be some benefits coming out of COVID. Not just for us, but for the world, just like realizing, oh, some of my employees are more productive when they work at home if they want to, or some of my colleagues can work from home, or I live in a rural area and I realized I don't need to drive 45 minutes to see my doctor, refill my medication, like all that kind of stuff is going to change how things work. And it's not happening overnight, so hopefully like the work continues.
More broadly, let's say outside of COVID.
Yeah.
I think we kind of talked about this before. Like, I'm not sure. It seems like one of two things or a combination of both is taking place. It's either people are generally more anxious now.
Yeah.
Or we're talking about it more.
Yeah.
Or both.
Yeah.
My intuition is that it's probably both.
Yeah.
The reason I say that is, and this is not an original thought, but I would blame it all on social media.
Yeah.
And my not an original thought is, I forget who said it, but it was, you know, it's like social media is this social experiment we've all signed up for, and there's seemingly no way to fully opt out.
Mm.
Like, you could, but not really, mm-hmm. at least from my perspective. I'm just curious what you think about all of that.
It's funny, because I'm the CEO of a startup. We need to do marketing. I have a team who runs our Instagram and Facebook and Twitter. At Tranquility App is the handle. And I have to apologize once a week to them. I'll be like, hey guys, you guys are doing a great job on social media. I'm sorry if I'm not like letting you guys know, or I'm not seeing all your posts, because I actually don't use, I try my best not to go on any of those platforms. I don't.
Yeah.
For my personal life, I just don't. I use Facebook Messenger because that's how my friends communicate, but I'm not on Facebook. And when I am, because it happens, sometimes it's 10:30, I'm like, I'm going to open up Instagram. And 5 minutes later, I just scroll for 5 minutes. What the hell was that? And now I'm just jealous about a bunch of different stuff. So social media it has some benefits, obviously, but yeah, I think there's way more pressure on everyone to be their best self all the time, because they're looking at Facebook or Instagram or whatever it is the kids are using these days, and they think everyone else has their life together. that's a huge thing, and that's going to affect the youth. We're still pretty young, but at least we have the insight to remember a time when those things didn't exist, and it's probably a bit easier for us to go, like, that's not real life. But if you're 9 now, and you have a smartphone, and you're on social media every day, it's not going to be good. Was this a two-part question? Oh.
It was kind of all in one. I'm just not... The first part of the question was, do you think people are more anxious, or are we just talking about it
more? Oh, yeah.
Do you think people are more anxious, or are we just talking about it
more? Oh, yeah. It's... So, I've looked for, like, the... Because I get asked that all the time, obviously, right? And I've looked for the data, and there doesn't seem to be any clear data, because it's kind of hard to tell. Yeah. It's obvious that number two is true. Not only as a society are more people talking about it, and it's more acceptable to talk about it, but also, especially younger people are talking more about it, and every day there's more younger people coming in, right? Because, like, for the most part, mental illness in general kind of usually manifests itself in late teens to early adults. Like, that's when, like, most of, like, a diagnosis happens. So there's that. It's mental health. It's social media. And there's other factors, too. Like, economically, sin hasn't been easy for our generation and earlier to come out with college, have all this debt, and it's just, like, it's not the same playing field that our parents grew up in terms of just, like, moving up and all that kind of stuff. So it's a lot of different pressure, and people are looking at things differently.
Sometimes I think how lucky we could be if society would have an expectation of, like a 3-day work week or a 4-day work week. Like, we kind of just stumbled, it seems from my perspective, we kind of just stumbled upon a 2-day, you know, weekend.
Yeah.
I understand that many people listening to this don't have regular work hours and you know, 2-day weekends, and, you know, obviously. But still, that's the societal expectation. It seems like that's not getting... We're not moving in that 4-day work week direction. It doesn't seem to me at all. It seems to be, if anything, we're going to the 24 hours a day direction, and that...
Well, it's really interesting because I saw, like, I'm sure it was an article. I just, unfortunately, as is part of being... living in this technology world, you see headlines, you don't even read the article. But, like, the headline was, like, should Canada move to a 4-day work week? And, like, it's like, yeah, that would be amazing. It's never going to happen. Because we could only do that if the U.S. did that. Like, if we decided we're going to go to a 4-day work week, all of our companies are no longer competitive against the U.S. And, like, the U.S. and us as well, we're always competing against, you know, less expensive, let's call it, labor in Asia and all those places. So as the world becomes smaller because of technology, it becomes a playing field where you're competing against the entire world now. And different places have different benefits, but, like, it's this machine that's created, and everything is up. Our entire world in politics is based on this idea. That the economy has to grow every year. If it doesn't, and apparently the whole thing's going to fall apart.
Yeah, well, me and Marcel can certainly appreciate that. I wonder if I can circle back to something you said. You brought up, when you first go see your family doctor, it was like you had very few options. So it was like, well, here's your pill.
Yeah.
Do these pills work? What do we know about, are we still studying this? Is this something we know really well? I don't know anything about the research in this area.
I'm not sure how accurate this statement's going to be, or if it's just a bit more of an analogy, but basically we know more about the surface of the moon than we understand how the brain works. That's number one. Number two is, we do know that anxiety and depression is highly influenced by brain chemistry and serotonin and dopamine levels in our brain. We know that We know that modern-day antidepressants, which are SSRIs, which is like serotonin rupture intake, there's another word in there, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, right? In other words, it stops your brain from throwing some of that serotonin in the garbage, in a really crude way to put it. So that those will help you with your mood. We also seem, so that's, and that's helpful. So if you're really depressed or really anxious, like, those are really helpful tools to get you out of a really hard spot, I think. The long-term data seems to show that there's diminishing returns. So the problem with medication is that, theoretically, you're anxious or depressed because there's something, quote-unquote, wrong. Especially depression. Like, if you're depressed, I think it's pretty easy. If you're depressed, I think it's pretty easy to assume that you're not probably not living the life you want to live. And so you're getting depressed about it. Anxiety is a little bit more difficult because basically what's happening there is your fight, flight, or freeze response, which evolved to keep you safe from danger, now has an overactive alarm so that things that aren't putting you in danger is putting, you're telling your body, I am in grave danger right now, when really it's like, maybe something potentially embarrassing is going to happen, or you're worried about this thing, but like, you're not going to die, which it was designed to keep you from dying. When that alarm's too sensitive, it like wreaks havoc on your life, because you're just, it's stopping you from doing a bunch of different things. So those pills can help diminish that, but I think it really takes, I'm not even going to say therapy, it takes figuring thoughts or ideas or what stories you're telling yourself to really, quote-unquote, fix that problem. And so what we do know for sure is that the best course of action for these disorders is a combination of both. And then I would say it seems as if you only do the medication route, that there's diminishing returns. Could work for some people, for sure. And it does work for some people, and that's great. And that also, I think head-to-head, therapy has longer positive effects. But therapy is hard. Any kind of therapy is hard work. Not everyone necessarily is ready or willing to go that route. I would say that.
I had somebody else had explained the anxiety thing. You know, you said the fight or flight, and then you added freeze, which, yeah, I guess that makes sense to add that in there.
Yeah.
It seems like we would have evolved those responses over time because we were, you know, some tiger. It's like, yeah, I had someone explain to me, we're interpreting the same degree of threat as if it's just a basic threat to our ego. You know, so we're just afraid.
Yeah.
Our ego is going to be diminished in this process, and our body is responding in the same way.
Yeah.
I always thought that was a kind of an interesting way to put it. But when you were saying that you're developing Tranquility Online to deal with depression,
yeah,
how different do those two programs look?
Yeah, it's been really fascinating to work with my co-founder and our team on that, because I've done CBT to help me with my anxiety, less so with depression, and then I kind of used another type of product for depression to kind of just see what's out there and all that kind of stuff. Basically, what we teach people in our program for anxiety, so let's go back for 1 second. Cognitive behavioral therapy. Cognitive is a fancy word for thinking or thoughts. Behavioral is our behaviors, and then the therapy is just the therapy part. So basically what we're saying is there's this last piece where there's the entire CBT framework is based on this thing called like the CBT triad or triangle. So if listeners want to imagine for a second a triangle, there's 4 corners. On top is thoughts. On the bottom right is behaviors. On the bottom left is feelings. What we're saying is it's like your thoughts actually influence how you think and how you feel, but also your behaviors influence how you think and how you feel, and how you feel influences how you behave and how you think. And then I always say we can't just choose, I want to feel good, but we can choose to change our behaviors, and we can choose to work on changing our thoughts. So what CBT does is, and we can choose to work on changing our thoughts. So what CBT does is, the thought part is someone who's anxious has automatic negative thoughts. All day long, things are happening to you, and you're automatically thinking the worst case scenario or something like that. And then the behavior is actually avoiding things. Like, I'm not going to do that because I can't handle it. Or I'm going to get anxious, or I'm going to have a panic attack. So that's the exposure part. So we solve behavior by stopping to avoid and exposing ourselves to the things that make us anxious so that we can gain confidence to a point where eventually we don't even think about it anymore. If I have to go to a networking event tomorrow, I'm not going to worry about it. I'm just going to show up and do it because I've done that and it doesn't bother me anymore. The thought part is taking that automatic negative thought and teaching you how to create a balanced thought. Not a positive thought, a balanced thought. If we talked about just positive thinking, if you're really anxious, I said, oh, that's like potentially a bit valid, but what about, like, what evidence do you have for that being the outcome and what evidence do you have against that? And most likely, if you try really hard, you can come up with like two things for evidence for and then like 15 things for evidence against. Then you come up with a balanced thought, which is like, that might happen, but probably not. And if it did, it wouldn't be that bad because of this. Like, you're pretty much convincing yourself, I'm not going to die at the end of the day, right? So sorry, a little bit of tangent there. But what I'm saying is the thought part for anxiety and depression is actually the same skill. Anxiety is about worrying about the future. Depression is about like being stuck in the past and telling stories about yourself of why you're not worthy and all that kind of stuff, most likely based on previous stuff. When you're depressed, you don't need to do quote-unquote exposure because you're not suffering from this anxiety thing. But what you are suffering from is not feeling like suffering from this anxiety thing. But what you are suffering from is not feeling like getting out of bed potentially and not doing the things that you used to do that make you feel good. You just don't feel like it anymore. So instead of exposure, it's called behavioral activation, which is basically we teach you how to start scheduling things in your life purposefully that either give you enjoyment or a sense of achievement. So it could be, you know, someone who's quite depressed, it literally could be, I'm going to clean my room today, or I'm going to make my bed, or I'm going to take a shower. If they weren't doing that before, just doing that one step, it's like you don't feel like doing it, so you don't do it. But then you don't feel like doing it, but you do it anyway, then you feel good. Then you have a more positive thought about that. And then the next day you do it again, and you start building on momentum. Or enjoyment is just like, you know, I used to like to go golfing, but I'm not in the right mood. Enjoyment is just like, you know, I used to like to go golfing, but I'm not in the right mood. Okay, go golfing anyway. Go golfing. Oh yeah, play golf. My friend Jeff was there. He made me laugh. I'm glad I did that. And you just keep building up more and more of that in your life. So that's, everything else is almost the same. I mean, I'm generalizing, but that's the main difference between CBT for anxiety versus CBT for depression is the behavior part, and one of them is exposure, the other one's quote-unquote behavioral activation.
Joel, I'm hearing you talk about what it is you do and how it is you do it, and it sounds like you have a real sense of responsibility to help people or to use this platform that you have built with your co-founder for the greater good of society and whatever that looks like. And it sounds very different from the guy who was in finance and felt an obligation to make money, get a sense of your self-worth through how rich you are, how much is in your bank account, or whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel now compared to how you were back then in terms of the good that you're doing in this business and your pride in it? And how do you measure success now versus before? And how does that physically make you feel and mentally?
So one at a time. What's the first one?
So I guess the distinction between, it sounds to me like you feel a sense of responsibility.
All right.
To do this and do it to the best of your ability versus in your previous life in finance, it was just about making money because of how you were raised and you measured success on money and success and all that kind of thing. Two very different things.
Yeah.
Right? So based on that sense of responsibility to make this platform the best it can be, how do you measure success is the first question now, today, versus how you used to. And just how does it make you feel relative to what you were doing before? And I'm just thinking of the person, and maybe they're feeling the same things that you did, and they don't know how to make a change or take that next step. And how do I even reassess what success means to me? And how do I know if it feels right?
Yeah, I mean, at the end of my previous career, you know, I was dragging myself to work every day. There are still some days where it's difficult for me to sit down at my desk and do the work I need to do. But it's different now because I have so many different people who are relying on me. So that's like a sense of, like you said, responsibility, and that's a positive factor. It goes back to the behavioral activation, really. It's like, oh, sometimes like I don't really feel like doing that task. It's not what I really like to do. Then I do it, and then I'm like, oh, I'm so glad I did it. I feel good now. I feel like I've accomplished something today. Even though it might not have been enjoyable, I accomplished something. And then in terms of like defining success, it's still difficult. Because if you wanted to say pure Joel number one, pure Joel two, number one is all about I need to make as much money as possible and then I'll be happy versus money doesn't matter and I just want to help people. Number two would probably be able to be really happy right now, but we live in a capitalistic society and I'm running a startup, and if we don't make money, we're not going to be sustainable. So the money part is always still involved and always super difficult. So part of the success probably does involve the money part, right? Like, but I think at the end of the day, once the money part gets sorted, it will not be about the money. It will be about like, how many people did we help this year? And it's amazing that like sometimes one story will, I'll be like having a bad day and talking to him, hey, how's it going? It's like, we had a story last week. One of, this is a coach saying this now, like I'm working with one of my clients and like, oh my God, he's doing so well. Really, like what's going on? We don't like, everything's always confidential. So it's like just kind of really broad stories, but basically like this client that I'm working with right now has not driven their car more than a kilometer away from their house in 25 years. And when they started our program, their goal was to drive to this, you know, place to go see their family, which is 30 kilometers away. And yesterday he did it. And it's like, holy, like, and then you kind of can refine it all the way back, like, as much as you are the coach and you know, the co-founder came up with all the content, like, at the end of the day, I made that happen, actually, which is kind of crazy to think about, like, and if that's one person, I thought about it too, I'm like, that's not only, like, his achievement, like, he showed up and his family was there, and now he can go visit his family, this is like, and that's one story, right, like, how many of those stories can we generate with Tranquility, and I think that is what will feed me and all my team, no matter what the money part kind of gets to.
To your point, though, the money, I think that's you're certainly focused on the right thing, but it kind of, like, I had something jump in my head there, which was, well, you know, money doesn't buy happiness, which is certainly true, but you don't need sneakers to run either, but it certainly helps.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It gets you at some kind of, you know, base level, right?
And for the first...
And that's the balancing act.
Well, it's like, for the first 2.5 years, I didn't pay myself a salary. So it was a huge struggle. I found different ways to... I had side jobs. I had money saved up. I sold half my retirement fund. I borrowed money. Parents helped. All this kind of stuff. Like, it was a... And now... I'm paying myself, finally, a salary that, I'm not the highest paid person on staff, but a salary that I'm like, this is a good salary. If I could just pay myself this for a little while, like, I finally just bought a car. I'm 33 years old, and I finally bought a car. Like, the struggle has been real financially. So, yeah, money is, you know, it's important to have a bit of money.
Yeah. But to Marcel's point earlier, and I'm glad you brought it up, because there is invariably going to be someone listening to this,
yeah,
who's probably,
well, you're
feeling like you, let's say you were several years ago.
Yeah, and you were talking about numbers, and maybe this is a good point. If we're wrapping it up here. Statistically speaking, 1 out of 5 people have mental. This is a whole different discussion, but. Calling it mental illness, I think the future might be a little bit different. It's let's just call it being a bit unwell, being mentally unwell, or even maybe a disorder might be even a bit better. But either way, statistically speaking, 1 out of 5 people will are have been diagnosed with a mental illness. But that's diagnosed. A recent survey before COVID, it was like in the tens of thousands of people that the National Post kind of just did a survey. And they found that 41% of people have admitted that they are currently struggling with some form of, again, mental unwellness. I think it actually had to do with anxiety. I think it's anxiety specific. And then COVID happens, and I'm sorry that I'm forgetting on the number, but I think it was above 60% of people were saying that, like, I'm currently finding this to be challenging for my mental health. It's just like, that's pretty soft. I think it was more extreme than that. And then with social isolation, all that kind of stuff. So the numbers are extremely high. So it's, as long as you have more than 3 listeners, then yeah, there's going to be people listening to this that are feeling something not great. And then in terms of like, if they're like me, then it's, yeah, pretty bad, like burnout, basically like can't do my job anymore. And COVID would have sparked so many different people. This thing about COVID is the social isolation, maybe losing job or income, all this kind of stuff. It probably hasn't caused a mental illness, but if people were either like susceptible or vulnerable to that, then this is potentially a trigger that would have made it worse.
So with that in mind, this would be a perfect time for a plug. Where can people find you again?
It's tranquility.app, so APP. That may have been a mistake on my part. Tranquility.com was too expensive for me to buy. The reason why I'm saying it's a mistake is that we don't like to think of it as just an app. It's a comprehensive platform. It's available, you sign up, it's available on your computer and or on your phone, both or just one, and it comes with a coach, and the coaching is done over like video, phone, or in-app messaging. So it's not just like an app and you use it a couple times in a day and then you're going to get better. It's like this whole system that has been created for you to do. The way we like to think about it is we've replicated as much as possible what you would pay my co-founder $200 an hour to do over 9 weeks, like 9 different help. But we highly recommend the coach because they're super helpful.
So thanks again.
This audio file is provided by RBC Wealth Management for informational purposes only. In Canada, RBC Wealth Management is the brand name that refers to RBC Dominion Securities, Inc. and applicable affiliates. In the United States, RBC Wealth Management is a division of RBC Capital Markets, LLC. In the United Kingdom and Channel Islands, RBC's Wealth Management International Division in these jurisdictions is comprised of an international network of RBC companies and includes RBC Europe Limited and RBC Investment Solutions CI Limited. In Asia, RBC Wealth Management is the global brand name to describe the wealth management business of the Royal Bank of Canada and its affiliates and branches, including Royal Bank of Canada Singapore Branch, Royal Bank of Canada Hong Kong Branch, and RBC Investment Services Asia Limited. The comments contained in this audio file are general in nature, do not have regard to the particular circumstances or needs of any specific person, and do not constitute legal, investment, trust, estate, accounting, or tax advice. They are based on information believed to be accurate and complete, but we cannot guarantee its accuracy or completeness. Unless otherwise qualified, any opinions, estimates, and projections in this audio file are those of the speakers as of the release date, are subject to change without notice, and may not reflect those of RBC Wealth Management. This audio file may not reflect all available information. The investments or services contained in this audio file may not be suitable for you, and it is recommended you consult with your investment advisor if you are in doubt about the suitability of such investments or services. In Canada, to obtain additional disclaimers concerning this audio file, please speak with your investment advisor.